Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is a legend of legends. He's probably best known for his tenure at Bethesda on games such as Skyrim, Fallout 3, Fallout 4, Fallout 76. He recently released his game, The Axis Unseen, that you can get right now on Steam. I'd like to welcome the jack of all trades, that is Nate Perkypile. How you doing, man?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for taking time out of your crazy schedule, I'm sure. Updates, polish, marketing, everything.
It's calmed down a little bit, thankfully. But yeah, no problem.
Yeah. You've done a lot of interviews, so I'm going to try and tread some new ground with you, hopefully, right? Oh. So you're not talking about things that you've talked about before. But one thing I haven't heard you really talk about before we get into the Bethesda and the Axis Unseen stuff is your small tenure at Retro Studios, right? Because you were there, and I've tried to find exactly what you did, but it's quite vague in terms of what you've done, and I couldn't find anything on ArtStation as well, because you did some of the world lighting and scripting of some sorts, but it doesn't actually elaborate on what that is. So can you just detail briefly what you're involved in there on Metroid Prime
2? Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's been so long now that I've updated my portfolio a few times, and, you know, the power of the Wii wasn't going to quite cut it for my art portfolio.
Yeah, fair enough, so fair enough.
I worked a whole bunch on, like, Skytown, did a lot of that. The destroyed space station thing, some stuff on Brio, and some stuff on Phase. Kind of all over the place, but Skytown was like the biggest chunk of it, but it was scattered across all those. And yeah, lots of lighting, and the cinematic scripting was like some of the cutscenes for Skytown.
Yeah. So did you come in near the beginning or partway through the development?
They had like a little bit of it there, but it was just a few levels that were actually done at that point. Like, hey, look, this is what the art's going to be like. But so I was on at that place for about a year and a half.
Yeah. Is it true that part of the reason you left is because you were going a bit insane working on one room a month?
Yeah, I would say that's not my style. Like, I learned a lot about how to bespoke craft in every intersection and literally every single crack in a room. But I was like, oh my, this is like so completely unnecessary. And then if you need a change, like, you have to completely redo stuff. You can't just like, I'm going to move a wall. It's like, no, because everything perfectly interacts with each other. Like literally every single intersection. That's not an exaggeration. Like that was a whole big deal of like all these perfect little trims. Whenever anything would touch anything else, you couldn't ever jam anything, which can look nice, but a month for a room.
But were you aware of this did they tell you about this in the interview process? Like, hey, just be aware, this is what you're in for. Or did you learn this as you were doing it? Like, oh my gosh, this is intense.
They did show me a few of those in the interview. They like opened up this Maya file to show how they built stuff. And like when I was at Terminal Reality, we built those games pretty fast at Terminal Reality. So we did do modular stuff like on Skyrim and all that.
Right.
When I was at Terminal Reality. So then I saw like these Maya files of just like absurd number of polys and all these intersections. Like, you do what now? Okay, I guess I'll learn a lot.
Wow. Yeah, but I can see how that would be a bit insane, and it almost seems like the antithesis of how Bethesda would work.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Like, there is literally no way you could ever ship a Bethesda game working that way. Not unless you like employed literally an entire country.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I suppose the Metroid games are a lot smaller than Bethesda games. But it's interesting because obviously you left Retro and you go to Bethesda and then you work out, you end up working on Fallout 3, which I suppose is actually a pretty good segue to go from Metroid Prime 3 to Fallout 3, because I suppose they're still first-person games. But was it easy for you to adapt to that culture straight away when you moved to Bethesda?
Yeah, I think so. And because I had worked with some of the people back at Terminal Reality who were on those games, and Fallout was like a huge deal to me growing up. And then I was already okay at destruction and stuff because of some of the stuff on the Metroid games had some destruction and tracks and all this, a lot of similar techniques for that stuff. Just, you know, not quite in the bespoke artisanal way.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. How did you find actually working within the color palette of Fallout 3, though? Because around about that time, it felt like games were really big on just the brown color palette. And I would find that quite limiting, I would think, to work within that set of constraints.
It's definitely very, very stylized, and that was a big thing back then. That was honestly part of how you made it look okay, though, by being stylized in that way, because that was back before we even literally had shadows. Like, that was a whole argument that I had to have going between Fallout 3 and Skyrim of, like, we should have shadows. Like, and then it's like, do we really need to? They're really expensive, but it's really, really hard back then to have the hardware power to do that with, like, dynamic time of day and stuff. So that stylization was somewhat necessary. But that said, obviously, I have, like, different opinions on color that you could probably pick up on looking at my games now and, like, are directing Fallout 76, which is definitely not monochromatic.
Yeah. So when Fallout 4 came up in discussion, were you one of the ones who were advocating for, like, hey, can we have some vibrant colors, please?
It didn't have to be as much of a push as I thought, honestly, because it was part of what we wanted to do to make sure it stood out from 3 as kind of its own thing. Because instead of being iterative, like all the sequels at Bethesda were often like trying to reinvent it every time, not just, you know, yearly Assassin's Creed type thing. So even though I did spend 10 years working on Fallout games, we tried every time to like overhaul quite a bit.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, what do you think of the Fallout TV show?
I thought it was great, which was a nice, you know, change from, you know, I worked at Terminal Reality, right, which had Blood Rain, which had Blood Rain 2.
Yeah, 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 of course.
Which is terrible.
Yeah, and video game adaptations haven't been the greatest for the longest time, so I was optimistic because Jonathan Nolan was involved. Yeah. But yeah, their attention to detail was second to none. I think I hope I'm not butchering his name, but Ilya Nazarov, he did a sketch of your cats, right? And it ended up in the show.
It did.
Yeah.
Someone sent me that and I was like, dang, they like, because they obviously could have just like grabbed paintings from Target or whatever, but all the background stuff was all like from the game. It was amazing. Like the most random small signs from Diamond City that I had. And I was like, hey, I see that sign on that shop. Like, it was amazing. It was really weird, honestly, like after staring at that stuff literally for a decade and just seeing them being like bolt for bolt accurate on everything.
Yeah, and were you able to just appreciate it as a fan, or were there parts of you that was kind of picking everything out because you'd worked on the games for so long?
I think it made me appreciate it more just because if you could tell how much they cared about it and the attention to detail, and I've always been a big fan of that universe, and to experience something again as a fan. Like, I had seen some super, super early stuff, but it was just like a couple set pictures and stuff. I never saw like early cuts of the show by the time I left or anything.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was brilliant. I think it's the best video game adaptation ever, personally. I think by the time this airs, it would have already been announced, but it'll probably win best video game adaptation at the Game Awards, I'm assuming.
I could definitely see that happening. And I think there's been a lot more good stuff lately, but I agree that it's probably the best. Like, I really like The Last of Us, but I also wish it was more episodes. Like, it felt really compressed to me.
Yeah, and it's also a direct translation, whereas Fallout was its own thing. Yeah, so they really, they treated new ground as opposed to just taking what already exists and directly translating it. So yeah, it was good. I did want to ask, because I find the story absolutely hilarious. You handed in your resignation to Bethesda on April Fool's Day. Was that intentional? Did you know it was April Fool's Day, or did you just forget? Because it is easy to do.
It just kind of happened to work out that way. It wasn't like, ha, 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 I'm going to troll them. It was like, okay, you know, because of this and this reason, and I'm going to do it on this day, and I guess that's going to be April Fool's. That's funny anyways. Let's just do it. I didn't want to wait any more, really.
Yeah. So who are you handing the resignation into? Is it, are you giving it to Todd or are you giving it to a manager? And what was the response?
I think it was my, like, the lead producer at the time, Angela Browder. And it was definitely like, wait, are you serious? Because especially after that many years.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I'm just trying to imagine the conversation. Because it'd be like, nah, you're trolling. Surely you're trolling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. They should have seen it coming, obviously. Like, I had the inevitable, like, what can we do to have you stay? And it's like, I had been bringing up issues about things I wanted addressed for quite some time before that. So I don't think it was, like, just random.
Yeah, and it's well documented at this point that you were getting a bit frustrated with the amount of meetings that you were having and the fact that Bethesda had ballooned into this giant machine and everything was becoming managers. You know, you'd have to speak to a manager who speaks to a manager just for it to funnel to the right person.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the number of producers on Starfield is like more than the size of the team on Fallout 3.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's like a producer for every 6 or 7 people or something like that. I forgot what exact ballpark number it is for that, but it's there's some metric like that where they try and have that for managing all the tasks and everything.
I wonder
which is
if
a lot.
Yeah, I wonder if that's even necessary. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you're obviously in the trenches, so you'd probably have an understanding of it, but there must be a more efficient way of doing it, surely.
I think it depends a lot on the personality types of who you hire as part of it. Like, some people, like, I think I'm obviously one of those people who can just be like, do this thing, and I'll do that thing, and I'll probably even get it done ahead of time or whatever, but some people need to be like, here's the thing, here's exactly when you need to finish it by, and then they need maybe more checking up on. So it depends on the personality type and the experience level. And at that scale, you can't necessarily be as picky, I think.
But yeah, that's
it's true. Not the way I like to work.
And of course, on top of that, you got outsourcing as well. That's tied into the production.
Outsourcing and the fact that it's multiple studios. So
that's right.
Inherently leads to lots of communication issues and inefficiencies where you do need all these approvals and stuff. Because it's a lot easier when you're in like one spot and everyone has worked together for like, when I was at Bethesda earlier on, like the average for how long someone worked there was like 10 years. And I'm like, there's no way that's true anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Because it was a high retention rate for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware, it started to, people started to leave, was it around like Fallout 76 time? Is that when it started to happen? Yeah. Yeah. Do you think it's possible then for, given everything you know and how everything's ballooned, and I know you've said previously that Starfield was a bit sterile and it didn't have the sense of wonder that Skyrim and Fallout 3 had, how they can navigate that with Elder Scrolls 6? Because it seems like Skyrim was very much a product of its time. You had a small team. You were largely left to do what you needed to do. And there wasn't management and meetings all the time. So do you think Elder Scrolls 6 is just, is there too much of an expectation on it? Or do you think it's going to be fundamentally just a completely different game?
I think it's such a high bar to hit that it's almost like, even if it is amazing, you'd probably still end up with like not nearly as good Metacritic scores just because of those expectations. It's like literally people's childhoods now. They're like, oh, growing up, that was my favorite game. Like, why isn't there another one? Like, so it's all always going to be like tinted by these nostalgia rose-colored glasses and all that. So that, I don't envy them. I hope it turns out really great, but that's going to be really, really hard. So internet is not the nicest place.
No,
as
you learned with Fallout 76. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember Bruce saying to me that like marketing must be weeping in terms of how they're going to deal with the marketing for it because obviously if it doesn't get a 95, he put it as if it doesn't get a 95% on Metacritic, then it's a failure, you know, because of the reality of the expect versus the expectation. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's going to be a fire hose of money that marketing is going to spend too.
Yeah, yeah. And they're under the Microsoft umbrella now, so they probably have access to more money. So it'll be interesting. The good thing for you is you can play it as a fan, right? Because you're not attached to the development, so you can go in with no knowledge and just enjoy it. And hopefully don't get into game developer mode and start critiquing everything.
I mean, it's kind of hard not to do that with, like, literally every game.
Yeah.
But if a game is good and stuff, then I can still get, like, sucked in and stuff. Because there are some developers you talk to where they're like, I can't play games anymore. I'm definitely not like that.
Yeah, there are some game developers that I've spoken to that literally have not played a game for, like, 10 years. They're just like, nah, that's I don't...
Yeah, I don't get it, though. Like, especially if you're on design, I feel like that is super dangerous, actually, to not be staying on top of your medium and, like, what's improving with it. Like, sure, maybe if you're on the art side and you're just, like, making cool armor all day, you'll be fine. But if you're in design, I think you absolutely have to be playing games.
Yeah, well, some of the reasons they use is, one, they spend a whole day looking at a screen. So the last thing they want to do when they go home is look at a screen. So I can somewhat understand. Yep. And the other reason might be they don't want to be influenced by something else and be like, oh, I saw this cool idea in this game, so let's chuck this into this game.
I think that's kind of short-sighted and not how art throughout all time has been made. It's like, just because you've seen something doesn't mean you're going to immediately directly rip it off. Like, you will iterate and build upon stuff. Like, maybe if you're going to be really lazy about it, sure, you just straight up rip off a mechanic. But there's a lot to be experienced and seen, and things keep evolving over time. And I think there's a lot to learn from playing other things.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a time thing as well. I am very much impressed with Todd Howard, how he manages to do everything that he does and somehow still find time to play quite a lot of video games, by the sounds of it, from what I've seen in interviews.
Does he?
Yeah.
I thought he just played Madden.
No. Well, I've seen interviews with him. Like, he did one recently with Lex Friedman maybe a year ago. And yeah, he's still up with it. He knows what's going on.
That's good.
Yeah. What was your dynamic with him?
I mean, we got along. Yeah. So, like, some people would be, I suppose, scared of him because they're like, oh, that's Todd Howard. But, you know, I was there when we were like 60 people or whatever. So I always talked to him fairly regularly. So to me, I was just like, yeah, just go talk to Todd. He's fine.
Was that still possible by the time you got to Starfield, though? Or had it?
I mean, it definitely got a lot harder because he was a lot busier and, like, you know, needed to fly off to all these other studios and stuff. But I suppose at the level that I was, I'd probably talk to him more than, you know, you're some new person who got there after everything got big.
Yeah. Makes sense. I did want to ask, because this is something I highly admire about you, and I'm somewhat envious of as well, is your ability to manage quality and quantity. A lot of your peers talk about how good you are at this. So is this something that you've just naturally had, or is this something you had to work on quite a bit? Because I feel like the Axis Unseen is pretty much the epitome of this, given how much you've managed to do in the short period of time.
I think it is kind of a learned skill, but it's always one that's been really important to me, because, like, way back in college, I sat in the back of class and I would always watch people working on their art, and it just, like, really, really sunk in how deeply inefficient most people are at doing stuff, where they would just literally stare at a model and, like, pan around it for hours and stuff. And so it was always really important to me to just find the most efficient way to be spending my time. And, like, if you ever start to slow down and you're, like, getting these, like, minor gains, like, just pivot, move on to something else. Like, if you come back later with fresh eyes, you're likely going to make, like, 10 times more progress than just sitting there, like, noodling stuff for hours. And that's something that a lot of people have problems with, where they just feel like it's, like, not quite there yet. But I think it's good to just move on, and you're going to learn more every time you do something new also, as opposed to doing, like, the one perfect thing. I think there was even some study about this where they got, like, two sets of people to do pottery, and, like, one of them was like, make the perfect face, and the other was like, make 30 of them. And by the end, the one that made a whole bunch of them did a much, much better job and could more consistently have good results.
That's actually good. Yeah, that's a good thing. It's a good practice. It's interesting because I'm of the view that every single person you meet, you can learn something from. Even stupid people, I think you can learn something from. Sometimes you can learn what not to do. But anyway, like, if you're looking at another artist and the way they're doing things, are you looking, do you get inspired by it, or you look at it and you think, okay, I am not going to do it the way he's doing it? Because that just
looks so unproductive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of artists that you learn from just watching them do things wrong.
Yeah. Same with Crunch, I would say. Because a lot of the people that I've worked with over the years who have crunched the most, not that efficient. It's like, you're crunching, but you're also like chatting about Destiny for 3 hours. A lot of, you don't really need to be there at the office quite that much.
Yeah, well, I would think it would lessen the productivity as well, because if you're crunching, then you're not as alert as you usually would be, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm of the opinion that it works in like short controlled bursts. Like, I don't think it's fair to say that it's useless forever and never has its place. But if you're going to do it for more than like a few weeks, like, yeah, you start to have a drop off and it doesn't really work.
What was your commute into the studio when you were there?
At first, I lived pretty close, like 10 minutes away or whatever. But then later, really it was more like 45 minutes, which was,
that's not too bad.
The worst, but not great either.
Was there anyone else at Bethesda that was doing some stupid-ass commute?
Oh, yeah. Some people would come from pretty far.
Like how long was the commute? How long were we talking? One way.
Well, yeah, one way. Definitely some people were like 2+. Because with the way like Maryland and DC is, like, it's not like there's one central place and everyone comes from the outside. There's all these multiple cities. There's like Baltimore, DC, sprawling suburbs forever. So some people lived pretty far away.
I would think you'd get mental fatigue before you even get into the office, though. And you'd already not be working at the capacity that you probably needed to or would be able to if you didn't have to do that long commute, especially if you're driving.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm big on
one person who ended up having their office then at the ZeniMax Online Studios instead of Bethesda, because they actually lived much, much closer to that one. And then they didn't have to drive a couple hours every day, you know, especially now that there are multiple studios. Like, I'm of the opinion that it's basically a remote job now anyways. Like on 76 at one point, it was me and one other artist would just go into the meeting room and then call into a meeting with everyone in Texas. It's like, so we're driving all the way in just to like remote into these meetings.
Yeah, that seems like a waste of time.
Yeah, that was before COVID and everything even too. So then once that finally came, it was like, oh, remote? That's easy. Our meetings have been remote for years.
Well, I suppose that's one of the good things of COVID. I suppose it's just fast-tracked remote work somewhat, but there are some companies now that are trying to get people to go back into the office, but I don't know how productive that is.
I think it's often a way to like soft fire people, honestly.
Yeah, I agree. Or because they have they've got a lease on this commercial property and they have to fill it, right? So
yep. That's 100% it there.
Yeah So the Axis Unseen, the tree golem thing in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, was that inspired by Shadow of the Colossus at all?
Not directly. Like, I would say the game in general is, with just like the tone of it and everything, but that specific design isn't inspired by that. It's more of just like my thinking of what a tree golem would be, because trees are small or like narrow and tall, but often you have tree golems that are like these big hefty dudes, which I was like, that doesn't really look like a tree. It's so wide. So
I was thinking, because I was wondering, I was like, is it inspired by Shadow of the Colossus or like Treebeard from Lord of the Rings or something? Because you never know where these things come from in terms of the inspiration. But
yeah,
I was curious, that's why I wanted to ask.
Yeah, I kind of just made it up, because I was like, I want it to be tall. So behind the scenes, it looks like just this tall stick figure. And then I got a bunch of sticks and I just kind of like laid them out on it. And I was like, that looks cool.
How far in the development process did that come? Was that early on, or?
That was super early on. That was when I was doing my like initial prototype to prove out whether or not I could actually do this game and if the metrics worked out for how much I wanted to build too. So it was in the first few months. Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, it's 5 times the size of Skyrim. Was that always set in stone? Did you always plan it out that way? No.
No. I had like a list of regions, but the specific size came about from basically playtesting. And everyone always like freaks out when they hear that number and like, oh, how could you do it? But honestly, like that's the easy part, which sounds nuts, but I don't know. I've made lots of open world games and honestly, Skyrim is like quite compressed really. So it was not that hard to build the big open landscape. It's all the systems and everything else are dramatically more complicated. Like I could make it 10 times as big as Skyrim and probably still ship the thing. It's like placing rocks and trees and managing sight lines. All of that is manageable. At most, there's like little issues you run into with like setting up navigation data and not having the game freak out. Like that takes a little bit of iteration.
Right, because Bethesda's well known for feature creep, right? Where it just keeps adding stuff to the game. So were you intentionally trying to avoid that problem where you're just like, oh, I want to chuck more stuff in the game. Oh, let's just chuck more stuff in the game.
I tried to account for it, I'd say. Like, I had my schedule, but I did have a buffer in there, and I did add stuff over time. But I think it's stuff that the game needed, really. Like, at first, there wasn't melee weapons. It was, like, just a bow game. There was no magic system. But it kind of came out of playtests of, like, needing other ways to approach combat and all that. And that, to me, wasn't necessarily feature creep as opposed to intentional iteration that was accounted for. I do wish I had an even bigger buffer for when the game was like mostly locked off to then iterate even more, because I did have to crunch more than I wanted to at the very, very end. But overall, like it had everything I wanted to. I didn't actually cut anything I can think of and did just add stuff and shipped it.
Because I think I saw on your TikTok, you basically had a breakdown of your timeline in terms of how it was like a line graph of some sorts, and then it shows you the
like
timeline.
Yeah, like a major milestone.
Yeah, yeah. And it's quite a good way of doing it. And I suppose you hit every single one. And also, you were working from what, like 8 till 4 every day?
Yeah,
roughly?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're quite sensible in terms of how you were spending your time.
Yeah, I almost never hit like even a full month, like 160 hours in a month. Like I do all this time tracking and rarely hit that until the very end where it goes kind of nuts. But generally it was pretty low, yeah. And I hit all those deadlines. But I also clustered it that way just kind of as an efficiency thing, because like if I'm going to do one creature, I might as well do them all, because I can get in like this, you know.
A zone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a production pipeline thing.
Well, that's the other thing. Just to go back to the whole meetings thing, that would mess up, especially for like a designer or an artist, the zone. Like if you're getting into a zone and you're doing stuff and it's like, oh, I've got a meeting, that immediately cuts you out, and then you come back and then it might take you a while to get back into the zone. Did that happen often at Bethesda, especially towards the
end? Oh, for sure. And because there's a cost before and after. It's like, it can ruin a whole bunch. So every meeting has a cost beyond even just the sheer cost of the meeting itself, which I wish that there someone did like a UI mock-up of like, what if meeting requests had the actual cost when you did it? Like, I wish they did that, because, oh, man, so expensive.
Yeah, because I've worked for companies in the past where I've attended meetings and I'm like, would anyone actually really care if I wasn't here? You know, or it's like,
or
why
this
do
could
I
be an email.
Yeah, like why do I need to be here? Why is this meeting taking place? Because sometimes it does feel like the meeting is being held just for the purpose of the person who's having the meeting. So it looks good to their superior. You're like, oh, I had a meeting about this. But I don't know how productive it is. I mean, how many of those 20 meetings you were having a week would you say were actually productive?
I think you could easily have done like a quarter of the meetings. And this is also something I did on like when I was art lead on 76, I just like ended up canceling more than half of the meetings as we went to ship. It's like, cause so many of these meetings were like standing meetings every single week. It's like, what if we did every other week? It's like, hey, guess what? It's fine. Like there's something to be said for like early on when you need to have more discussions to like figure out what the project is and have all these discussions. But then I think once you know what you're doing, like you should be, oh, I don't know, working and making the thing.
Fair enough, because you were lead on Fallout 76, so that pretty much right. is just meetings, right?
Yeah,
that is the job.
It is the job, and like some people don't like it when they are lead and have that. But then also you have to think about what meetings you're making the rest of the people have, and that's why those are the ones that don't necessarily have to be that way or to be as long. Like I had to sit in meetings sometimes where they were like scrolling through the Slack channel about updates people posted. It's like, dude, we're all in that Slack channel. Like, if someone didn't look at it, that's their problem. Like, I want new information and discussion.
Yeah, yeah. But how did you find it managing creatives? Like, when you're in the position where you're... Because obviously you've been in that position. You understand what it's like as a creative person. But then when you're managing creatives, are you trying to give them as much freedom as possible? Or are you trying to keep them on a bit of a leash? Is it a combination of both? What are we doing here?
I think it depends a little bit on the artists and how much they need, but generally I think my perspective on that as a lead on 76 was that I like to give people as much freedom as possible within the constraints of what the project needed. Be like, hey, here's this region. It needs to kind of look like this, but as for how you specifically execute that, and like, I want you to kind of make it your own, because, you know, it's also pretty well documented. That's why I thought Skyrim and stuff worked well, is having people have those creative freedoms. Whereas if you're just like micromanaging people, I don't think that gets really good and interesting results, and often also results in them being more inefficient, slow about doing it, because frankly, they don't care as much then.
So did you advocate to be lead, or was that a situation where Todd or someone else came up to you and was like, hey, do you want to be lead on Fallout 76?
Yeah, I had been asking to have a position like that. And I think like Point Lookout and The Pit way back on Fallout 3 were kind of like soft tests for that, because, you know, I basically had that job on those two things. And I think it went really well. Like, people still really like Point Lookout to this day.
Yeah. Did you ever get any input into any of the UI on any of these games? And there is a segue. There is a reason why I'm asking this. You probably know where I'm going with this.
That was one of the areas that, like, I would say Todd cared about a lot. So I largely tried to divorce myself from being involved in the UI. And I have many opinions on it. But...
So...
You know, the Eye of Sauron is on something. I'll let Sauron deal with it.
So does Todd get quite passionate about UI?
Yeah. Like, plenty of people could go their entire career there and maybe not even talk to him, possibly, especially now. But when you're talking about UI, like, he literally cares about the kerning of fonts. Like, that is 100% not an exaggeration. The level of detail.
Wow.
Yes. So I was like, okay, have at it.
That's hilarious and interesting at the same time.
The most that I pushed on really was that I wanted the map to be not monochromatic and stuff. I didn't want another like green scan line looking thing for the map. So I did push to get the map for Fallout 76 to be like the hand-drawn map.
So how much convincing does he take in those sort of scenarios when you're trying to convince him of something? Does it take one meeting? Does it take multiple meetings? Like, what are we talking?
Depends on how much he agrees with you in the first place, probably.
Okay. That's funny. Well, I suppose I understand even more so why being an indie is so great. Because you control
I do
everything.
What I want.
Yeah, you do what you want whenever you want, right? And
yes.
And that's partly why I bring up the UI, because obviously you did a real cool thing with the UI in the Axis Unseen, right? Because it's actually on the bow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did that process start quite early?
Yeah, I would say that's like a somewhat of a pillar of the game. Like, from the beginning, I wanted to do that, and I've always liked, you know, diegetic UIs, you know, if you want to get all fancy about it. But yet it was kind of a reaction to the how it feels to play a Bethesda game after so many years being there. It's just like, I am so sick of menus right now. If I have to manage my inventory and like, oh, I'm overburdened, like, that my game is not going to have that.
Simplify the pipeline.
Good yeah, idea. Like, obviously I had a lot of fun with those games and I've played like a ton of them, but I think there's also a space to not do that all the time.
Yeah. So you worked obviously with the Root engine a little bit on Metroid Prime 3. Did you?
Was that what it was called?
Yeah, so that's long. What it's called, the Root engine. I forgot the name. But there's that, and then obviously there's the Creation engine with Bethesda, and then obviously you're working with Unreal Engine 5. Mm-hmm. What would you say are the differences between all three engines, and which one would be your favorite by far? I think well, that's kind of a rhetorical question. I think I know, but I thought I'd still ask you anyway.
They all have their different approaches, and like I would say every studio that I worked at before Bethesda, like tools were absolutely rock solid, both at Retro and Terminal. Like they were very strong and focused technically, and like those builds didn't crash and it was amazing. But then when you're doing like this open world thing with all these things going on, like it was very difficult to get work done sometimes. So that said, at the time it was stuff that not everyone was doing, but I think that has shifted since, and open world games are no longer this weird fringe thing like they were back then. And Unreal 5 has been an amazing thing to work with, where I don't have to spend all this time loading the game and stuff. Like if I want to see a change, I just hit play in the editor, and that, like that alone is this absurd amount of hours that I get back working on the game. Like there's no way I could have shipped this game in 3.5 years if I had to load the entire thing every time I wanted to see a change. You're easily talking about doubling the number of hours you're going to spend sometimes.
Yeah, well, I'd think time is such a precious commodity that you'd want to utilize it as much as possible. That's why I'm a bit surprised they still keep using the Creation engine at Bethesda and they haven't maybe migrated to Unreal 5.
Yeah, I think it's pretty telling that there are some studios with similar tech that have made that leap lately, like CD Projekt Red going over there. It's like, it's not to say that it wouldn't be a ton of work. Like there's dialogue and quest systems to get up and running. Sure. That's completely true. It's not like you're going to just immediately be able to start making the game. But when you have such this broad tool base with also a big knowledge base that people can pull from, and it's easier to hire people and have them ramp up, I'm of the opinion that it's like a really, really strong tech base to work with. And it's easier to then stay relevant and not always be trying to play catch up. Like a lot of what was done on Starfield was trying to get all these rendering systems and animation systems sort of up to snuff. And it makes it really hard to even actually make the game. Like the way I've described it to people is like, you're on a train, but also laying the train tracks at the same time, like that Wallace and Gromit thing, but it's also on fire the entire time. Like yeah, that's what it feels like.
Yeah. I would think that the initial cost to migrate over to Unreal Engine 5 would be hefty sum initially, but you'd reap that reward in the long run later because everything would be a bit more streamlined.
I completely agree. And like having made open world games with both engines, to me, it's like absolutely no question that I think things would end up being better. That said, I don't think they're actually going to do that. I would be shocked if that did happen, because I don't know, people also have trouble changing their minds sometimes, where they made a decision at some point and it did make sense at the time, you know, 10 years ago. I completely agree, but I think it's important to reevaluate tech, and games are constantly changing. Like I started making games when we literally didn't even have color, so to always commit yourself to these decisions you made in the past, I think is dangerous.
Well, you saw with Microsoft recently with Halo, right, that they're migrating to Unreal 5.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and they spent tons of money trying to get that up to snuff. And it can be just this treadmill of burning cash forever and always being behind. It's really hard. And I know that some people are worried about like tech monopolies and all that. And what if there's only two engines? I just don't think custom engines make sense for most people. Like there are cases where it does make sense. Like, you know, you have that side scroller Noida or however you say it, where every single pixel is like an element. Like if you're doing something really, really different, sure. But a lot of games aren't. And like, I was never going to go indie and make my own open world engine. Like some people are like, you're only a true developer if you make your own engine. Like, no, that's actually just incredibly dumb most of the time.
Well, particularly if you want to get people to help you later on, right? If they've worked within Unreal Engine 5, then it's a lot easier for them as opposed to, I made my own engine, come help me. But then you have to learn the engine and all the tools involved with the engine. So, yeah.
And then anytime you have a custom engine, you also want to document it. Like, that was always, you know, not great at Bethesda, because you need dedicated tech writers and stuff if you're actually going to do that and have your documentation be correct, because it changes all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're thought of as the art guy, but you actually know design and programming as well. And didn't you write, you wrote a script or something for Fallout 3 to change the, like, the edge trimming? Was it the edge trimming?
Yeah, I would make my own tools and Macs and stuff to automate stuff, because they were doing that all by hand. So, because I, way back when I was a kid and stuff, I did programming before I did art. So having that background was really useful for automating tools. And I made my own, like, export scripts and stuff, because, you know, I was doing those kits for Fallout 3, but back then you could only export one model at a time. So you'd have to click on one, export it, click on the other one, export it. And I used to got, I was really good at it at the time, like when I would have to export my entire kit and people would think that there's, like, rats in my office or something, because you just hear click, because I'm just doing hotkey after hotkey. But then I wrote a whole script to do them, like, and the whole art team started using that because no one wanted to do that by hand. Eventually, they got, like, a real tool later. But even then, it took, like, a good year or two to convince the art team to actually use it. And they were like, I'm still using Perky's tool because mine was faster.
Kids these days don't know how good they've got it, right? These kid, these new kids on the block, these game developers, they don't know all the struggle back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Especially working within such tight constraints. But I suppose constraints can help breed new ideas as well, right? Because you hit a brick wall and then you have to find a creative way of solving it, as opposed to these days where you can just throw a whole lot of money at the problem.
Yeah, I think it's definitely good to be flexible and trying to figure out ways to do things within constraints. And, you know, the Fallout and Skyrim games are definitely built on constraints, even if they did have a whole bunch of money. Obviously, like, it wasn't infinite, and you always have to make these choices about what you're going to spend time on, because any open world game you could theoretically work on forever, because
yeah,
it's a world.
You could, yeah, but then it's a cost. Is it really worth it, you know, because games are increasing in terms of their scope, and the cost to make them is increasing, but the sales don't necessarily always justify it.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah. So, I did want to ask...
With inflation, also.
Yeah, inflation. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, so you got to wonder if maybe the scope will be dialed back slightly with some of these gains. I mean, I don't know how big Elder Scrolls 6 is going to be.
I mean, I think you'll still have your, like, tentpole AAA things, but I do think you've kind of seen exactly this happen with a lot of these things that are not quite that, and then they don't hit these sales marks, and then, like, it's honestly been the worst I've seen in the games industry my entire career over these past couple of years, with the number of studios shutting down. It's because these things are simply not financially viable to do that.
And I would think it would create a domino effect of negative morale, right? If you've got a whole bunch of people that are working for a studio, but in the back of their mind they've got anxiety that they might be laid off at any time, that's gonna affect your output, surely.
I absolutely think it is, and I think over these past couple of years, we've also probably lost plenty of people who are just like, I'm done with games, like,
yeah,
I can't keep doing this, because so many of these people have had to, like, jump around between, like, three or four studios where this keeps happening.
Yeah, yeah, totally agree. So, I did have some questions from the community that they wanted to ask. Maybe you can answer them, maybe you cannot. But we'll see how we go. Well, I'll ask you an easy one to start off with. This is from DevDev0079. What was your favorite project that you ever worked on?
I think probably Point Lookout, because it, like, we knew how to make the games at that point, and I was basically given full creative control along with Joel Burgess to make that. And even though it was only like 4 months or whatever, I had a lot of fun making it, and I'm super happy with how it turned out. So that was fun.
Good answer. Especially because it was your baby. in a way, isn't it? Yeah. So, yeah.
And there's some pretty clear parallels there between like Point Lookout and Fallout 76 and my game now of like, you know, spooky forest horror.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah. I didn't connect those, but now that you've said it, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Next one from Jesse Anderson. Based off previous Bethesda development timelines, what features content would be finished and in progress now that Elder Scrolls 6 has officially been in a full year of development? So this is, I suppose, a theory. How far along do you think it would be in the pipeline?
I mean, to be clear, I don't actually know, other than I know very little about the actual project, other than a couple
starter details. Yeah, I mean, you weren't even there, so.
To guess, I it's probably very, very early with, like, early blockouts. Most things are going to be just big cubes and, like, not working systems. It's like not going to be that far, I would guess. Especially because most people just came off of the DLC on Starfield, too. Because that wasn't a small number of people working on that. So yeah, they're probably just now getting to full production.
Do you think 2028, 2029, you think they'd be aiming for?
Yeah. Because if any game is going to get delayed, too, now that they actually do delay games and don't just, you know, 11, 11, 11, Mass Winter coming out. Like, yeah. Wait, what now? But yeah, since that game has so much riding on it, I wouldn't be surprised if it's pretty late. It has to be perfect.
Yeah.
Have fun. Good luck, guys.
Yeah, well, you have to get it right. I mean, you can see why GTA 6 has taken as long as it has.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's always been like Rockstar's way of working, too. So that's the norm for them.
Yeah, they just won't release a game until it's ready.
Yeah, it does help. How long did Red Dead 2 take? Like eight years or something?
Yeah, yeah. And it probably helps that GTA 5 is like a money printer. It just prints money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so
they money is not their problem.
Yeah, yeah. So this one's from Cancel Pro. What are some of the notable differences in how games are created between Nintendo and Bethesda? You only really worked on one game, so it's probably hard to say exactly.
It's a lot more design driven though, and also a lot more from, I would say, the core Nintendo group. Like, they had
Japan
people, from Japan who would fly in and care about the smallest details. Like, I was lucky on world art to not get too much of it, but on character art, they would literally be like, no, on this character, move this part on their shoulder down a little bit. Like, these are not people who worked on the game. This was people from Japan flying in to micromanage characters and stuff like that. So that's part of also why I left. Like, part of it was the tech and that being really stifling for an art career, but also that style of production. Like, I have never liked working with publishers or anything, but this was a whole nother level, even of like that level of micromanagement. I was like, dude, no way. That, in my opinion, if you're not directly working on the game, go away. Like, you can give feedback and guidance, but I don't think you should be telling the devs what to do. Like, you don't have all of the proper context and framing to actually be giving these critiques. And I think it's completely not how things should be made. Not to say that like Metroid didn't turn out great, but it didn't turn out great because of like some shoulder pad was shifted slightly. Like, I think that's kind of an unhealthy relationship.
So were you in some of these meetings, or was this like hearsay from other people telling you?
It was hearsay.
Yeah.
But it 100% did happen.
Yeah. But did that happen in anything to do with you? Did Japan directly comment on anything that you did?
No. But I had been at Terminal Reality. I did have that experience where I had to like make a level more colorful because the publisher wanted it more colorful. So I'd had that kind of experience with outside interference and had thoughts on it. But thankfully, yeah, I was fine at Retro and nobody at Nintendo was telling me what to do. But that's part of why I thought it was not great. Like, they're just choosing to focus on these individual things. Like, all the parts of the game matter, but then you get what we call the seagull effect, where someone just who's up top flies by and shits on something.
Yeah, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah, or other people call it the Eye of Sauron or whatever, where it's just like this one thing then gets all this attention. It's like, well, what about the rest of it? Like, why is it just that one thing? Because it just like catches their attention. And it's like, rarely makes that big of a difference and makes it better, and honestly just makes people demotivated having some outside person come in and give this feedback.
Yeah. I suppose I can see the pros and cons of it. I mean, it's very rare that Nintendo games are ever buggy or break or anything, so I suppose.
Yeah.
From that regard, but yeah, I can see how it would drive you insane. I mean, I've had micromanagers, and yeah, I've hated it, still hate it. I can't deal with it. So kudos to people that can deal with it.
Yeah, that's great for them. And if that they're happy putting out those games, awesome. But clearly, as someone who then was like, I'm going to make my own video game, that is clearly not my personality type.
No, totally. So you're on the right track. Something just occurred to me. I wonder if you can answer this. You might know, you might not know, I don't know. But I remember when, so Skyrim got announced for Switch, like it got announced for everything, right? And they had the cool Zelda Breath of the Wild skins and Hylian Shield and stuff. Naturally, in my head, I thought, oh, okay, cool. They're going to do a port of Fallout 3 and they'll include like Samus armor or Morph Ball or something. And then it just never happened. Do you remember anyone discussing this at Bethesda at any point?
Not that I know of, but I've always wondered that also. If I had to guess, it's probably just some like random tech thing that they didn't want to go through the tech effort of porting another game, because even though they are similar engines, I'm sure it would be a huge lift to get it up and running.
Yeah, that's true.
So
but
who
I
knows
suppose,
what the plans are?
I mean, but Switch has sold like 140 million units, so I would assume you'd make money. The cost would justify it, I would think. But then maybe Nintendo's like, no, we don't want you using. I mean, they're very protective of their IP, so.
Yeah, but that's not to stop them from putting out other games too. It's not like Nintendo's protective about their platform like they were back in the day. Like,
yeah, that's
now
true.
You can release more or less whatever you want. Whether or not they would do a crossover like that, like yeah, I could see them not wanting to do that. But still, it is surprising to me as well that they didn't at least do that port, because I'm sure it would run.
Yeah, like Fallout 3 would run easy, no problem.
Yeah, like yeah. It could run better than Skyrim. Doesn't have shadows.
Yeah. I mean, Fallout 4 might be a problem, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
4 is definitely a whole nother issue.
Yeah. I know you've spoken about this before, but in terms of porting Access Unseen to other platforms, I mean, and we did talk about this off air about how we need to clone you. in an ideal scenario, if you could, would you release it on PS5, Xbox, and I suppose Switch 2 at some point?
I think Switch,
you had the
Switch
bandwidth
2.
To do it. Yeah. Not Switch. That would be impossible. Well, not impossible,
yeah,
but it would be...
highly unfeasible, and if it did, it would probably run in that potato mode that I have, which it's like, that runs, but not what I would recommend. I would definitely like to do it, and I'm probably going to... once things calm down with like adding stuff to the game and fixing it and all that, I will probably poke at it at least, because I would like to do it, but at the same time, I don't want to pay a boatload of money to someone to do it unless I can guarantee that I'd get a good return on that, which is pretty dubious, especially frankly with Xbox. Like, I'll be blunt, like I'm not going to put it on Xbox unless I get a Game Pass deal, most likely, because I think most people don't buy games on that platform, and especially indie games. So that would be incredibly risky for me to go through all that effort to then potentially get almost nothing.
Yeah. And I suppose the audience of that platform has been conditioned to not buy games and to just play them on Game Pass. So yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, it would be cool. It'd be cool to see, but I also know you're a DIY guy. So there's probably a part of you that's like, no, I want to port it, as opposed to handing it off to someone else.
I mean, sort of. As like, I have built a whole game myself and like doing all these things, but also like the process of getting something on a console is not super fun.
Is that
like, it's
of,
not as hard as it used to be.
Is that because of certification? Yeah.
It is 100% certification and all these random little rules that you have to follow. And then...
what's an example? Yeah. Give me an example of something like ridiculous.
Well, like, if you're controlling the game and then one of the controllers loses battery or something, it's like unplugging controllers while it's live, and all these like weird little fringe cases that you have to handle, right. And then pop up the exact kind of proper prompt and handle it in the game correctly. It's lots of little stuff like that. So it's not just like, can it run on it and can it be fun? Can it use the adaptive triggers and stuff like that stuff? I don't really have an issue. It's all the other small stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose it would be easier to port from PC to console as opposed to the other way around, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think largely these days you're kind of talking about the same thing. They are effectively computers now.
It's yeah, not
like back on like the PS3, like that was
horrible, I'm sure.
Weird thing. And to anyone who played PS3 for Skyrim, I'm sorry, not my fault. So yeah, without having to worry about all those weird hardware things, definitely it's going to make it more straightforward. So I probably will poke at it for sure before I commit to anything in particular, and then read through all the cert stuff myself to see how much I want to hate life for a while. And then there's also like store backend stuff. That's always a whole nother thing. Like some are easy, some are hard, but getting it up there and like making all the key art with like the logo in the right spot. Like, do you know how many versions of your key art and logo you have to make making a game just even on the PC? Like, it's wild.
Really? Like how yeah. many are we talking? Roughly.
I've easily got like, I don't know, 30 or 40 for just different things.
Of the same logo.
Yeah. You just got to crop it in different ways and then move the logo around. Like, and that's all even just across different storefronts that everyone has their own ratios. And it's like, this is one that's 451 pixels by 84. It's all over the place. So I'm sure it would be the same thing where I would then have to make another set of those. Not that that's the hardest part. Like, I can whip those out really fast now. It's just like one example of how there's all these little things that you have to set up on any time you put out a game on any particular storefront.
Jeez, that sounds tedious as.
Yeah, I mean, that's like part of my job now. I have to do like all this backend stuff. Like, I'm in Steamworks all the time, like managing build depots and posting stuff and setting up all the ratings and the localizations.
I suppose the good thing is, like, if you want to take a vacation, you can. If you wanted to, right? I remember a story you told about how you went on vacation when you're at Bethesda. I think it was for a week. Then you come back and you had like 1,000 emails.
Yeah, that was like every time once I was a lead. And it's, for people who haven't heard that, it was emails that you like actually have to read to as a lead and respond to. You can't just be like, whatever, delete. Which,
so how
Todd
can you actually,
did, by the way, after he went on a sabbatical once for like quite a while. I think it was like 3 months. And then when he came back, he was like, I deleted all my emails. If you have something important, email again. It's like, I wish I could have done that. That sounds nice.
That's hilarious. That's so funny. I would think it would be hard to relax on vacation if you know you're going to come back and have that amount of emails.
Yeah, that's why sometimes I would just be like, you know what, I'm just going to check and respond to some of them, because it ultimately kind of isn't vacation, it's deferred work. Like, you're just like going to make pain for yourself when you're in that kind of position where most of your job is responding to that kind of stuff. Like, you just have to do it later, or something actually does go wrong. Because some people are like, I'm going to take a vacation, my company is set up where it'll handle things just fine and it'll go great. If that can be the case, awesome. But there are people who are in a position where you can't do that. So being indie, it is nice to be like, I'm on vacation, phone's off, whatever. Like, nobody else is doing work because I'm the only one doing anything.
Well, I think that's so important. I would think, and you could probably confirm that, if you have a company that's now as big as Bethesda's become, surely you could have the pipeline necessary so if somebody goes on vacation, somebody can take over seamlessly, as opposed to having to wait until you come back.
I think it depends on the position and like the experience level. Like, if someone is leading a whole department, is every single person under them, like, do they have someone who actually has the knowledge to steer that whole department? Like, sometimes the answer is yes. And there are people who are like, on the next game, you're going to be the lead, fine. But sometimes you have like the just a bucket of juniors or something. You're like, I don't know if that would be a good idea.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, I mean, that I guess that comes with the territory, though.
Yeah.
But I assume, and you don't have to answer specifically, but when you're in that type of role, the pay increases tenfold? Or is it just more responsibility? No?
It's just... No. Because the way positions work at Bethesda, too, it was per project. So technically speaking, like on HR paperwork, I was just a senior artist. So theoretically, like you get compensated better with bonuses and whatnot, but...
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Are bonuses tied to the Metacritic rating? Or is that BS? I've heard that.
That was just a thing for external studios for... I believe like Obsidian's contract had that. It wasn't that way internally.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would matter to some extent, but as far as I know, it was just like some portion of the profits and then gets split up then between people on the team.
Interesting. It is an interesting way of doing it in terms of you still being artist and then, but you're the lead and not being, well, I suppose there is compensation in terms of the bonus, but you don't even know if the bonuses.
You have to be like have a lot of faith, I suppose.
Yeah,
but those bonuses don't really come until after ship. Like you might have some mid-project bonuses, but the big ones would be after you ship.
Yeah, and I think I've heard stories where layoffs happened, and they were expecting a bonus, and then the bonus never came. Instead, they got a layoff instead. And
I'm like, yeah, that's exactly why I'm not a fan of that structure.
Yeah, that is not
that
good.
Kind of thing happens a lot. Not that it happened at Bethesda in particular, like.
Yeah.
Like they eventually had other layoffs, but not like the, hey, we are shipping the game, we're going to fire a bunch of people kind of thing that happens in a bunch of studios.
Yeah. It makes more sense to me now why you've said, yeah, I'm never going back to Bethesda. I totally understand why you want to go the indie route. It sounds like the best thing for you creatively, sounds like the best thing for you mentally. Some people like being a cog in the machine. You clearly don't. So. Good on you.
Yeah, I think the health aspect is part of it. Like my blood pressure was actually high at the time too, and then like as soon as I quit, like next time it was fine. Like I didn't drastically change my diet or anything, but like the stress of that kind of job is real when you're constantly having to deal with all that stuff and not really being able to take breaks. Like that's not super sustainable.
Yeah. And you're not even an anomaly in that case. I've spoken to heaps of devs, which, you know, they had heart attacks or like got stomach ulcers or a whole bunch of crap happened to them because of the stress of what they're doing. And then they might move to another studio or they quit or get out of the industry completely and they're fine. And they're like, why didn't I do this ages ago? You know?
So yeah, I've gone through this conversation with a lot of people that I worked with that quit where they basically like followed in my path of like, all the stress building up over time and then being better. It can be a lot.
Yeah. Cool. Well,
even though it's just video games.
Yeah, it is. I am going to wrap up there because I don't want to take up too much of your time, but final thoughts on, or any final things you want to say about the Axis Unseen, plug it as much as you can because we've got to get it out there. We've got to get people to play it and see it as much as possible. Pierce through the noise, so to speak.
Yeah, so if you want to check out a game that is not all like streamlined AAA stuff and trying to do something a little bit different, and it's all about immersing you in the world and hunting these folklore monsters, but with also some heavy metal when things get intense, you should definitely check out my game. And I'm adding more and more to it over time, so I'll be putting out a new patch this week where there's this cool map system where you find these like altars in the world. And then it unveils like a big 3D map in your safe area that you can see then. So you can get like a mental model of the map. Instead of constantly pulling out a map every 5 seconds as you're exploring, you can then see it kind of like a big diorama of what the world really looks like and build the mental model of it that way and navigate with these giant landmarks, like this 2 mile tall mountain with a skull on it. Yeah, so check it out. It's out now, and there's a demo also, and I keep the demo updated as well for any changes that go in.
That's brilliant. I think more games should have demos.
And it's a demo where the progress carries forward too, seamlessly, which yeah. more people should totally do because it's totally also like one number on the Steam backend. It's incredibly easy to do.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Nate, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for sparing me some of your time, some of your work time, some of your access unseen polish time. Go check out the game, everyone. You can get it right now on Steam. That is the show. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.